Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon.
Yes, it's 2:05. My name is Zeke. I'm here with Allison, Elizabeth, and Bettina, and this is Movement Museum on CKUT 90.3 FM on your radio dial, 91.7 on your cable dial, movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer, and all over the place, Twitter, Flickr. No, we don't have... Why don't we have a Flickr account?
We will... I set one up.
You set...
I just took lots of pictures with my iPhone.
Yes, there. And suddenly, before I get all excited about Flickr accounts and everything like that, I have a poem to read so I can calm down. And this one is called "You Are Gorgeous and I Am Coming." And after having Vincent Warren in last week, I think I'm just going to go and find every darn Frank O'Hara poem I can. Vaguely, I hear the purple roar of the torn-down 3rd Avenue L. It sways slightly but firmly like a hand or a golden down thigh. Normally, I don't think of sounds as colored unless I'm feeling corrupt. Concrete, Rambo, obscurity of emotion, which is simple and very definite, even lasting. Yes, it may be that dark and purifying wave, the death of boredom, nearing the heights themselves may destroy you in the pure air. To be further complicated, confused, empty, but refilling, exposed to light. With the past falling away as an acceleration of nerves thundering and shaking, aims its aggregating force like a metro towards a realm of encircling travel, reading the sounds of adventure and becoming ultimately local and intimate, repeating the phrases of an old romance which is constantly renewed by the endless originality of human loss, the air, the stumbling, quiet of breathing, newly the heaven stars, all out, we are all for the captured time of our being. Cool.
Good stuff.
Then there's a whole whack of other things involved in there, but we won't get into that because we have way too many people in studio here. Besides you got all the co-hosts, we have Miriam Millard from, and now I apologize if I'm going to, because I'm going to butcher the name of your company. Otra Orilla. Am I close?
Orilla.
Orilla. Okay, that's it. Allison, Elizabeth, and Bettina will be able to pronounce it much, much better than I will. And you're doing... performance at Sankey MSAL through until the 17th, if I understand correctly,
yes.
Right? And I think I'm going to get to see it because Bettina's already seen it. Allison, Elizabeth, and I are going to get to see it on the 16th. So if there's any sort of... Yeah, no spoilers, please.
Great.
Oh, damn.
And then we also have Rebecca... Oh, okay, fine. I'll just take off the headphones and close my eyes. And then we have Rebecca Halls and Julian Hughes from, I don't know... Hoopmaster, I hoop you. You teach at Studio 303 and all over the place, and we're going to get to everything. Yes. But yeah, thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
Who wants to start?
Oh, I want to start with saying how much I enjoyed La Otra Orilla. I saw it last week. I was sitting at the last row of Sankey MSAL. I was crying. It was so good. Can you tell El Mojo that, you know, he should come with the... with a warning that no woman can wear eyeliners. When he starts singing, it's just it just kills. It was a very... of course, your dancing was quite spectacular.
Thank you.
And you're on your own on stage. This is basically a one-woman show, dance-wise.
Dancer, yes. But there's four musicians and the video, so we tried to make it as much a non-solo in that ways as possible, being myself the only dancer on stage, yes.
It felt, in any case, like a duo because you dance not with another dancer, but with the singer.
Yes, exactly, yes. We tried this time around in this show to make to have the musicians move, just because in very traditional flamenco, they're very static at the back. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things in this show that we wanted to explore, to see how, by having the space of the musicians changing all the way through the show, how that would affect the dance in itself.
They felt part of the choreography.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, very integrated.
Yeah.
So I wanted to backtrack a little bit and ask you, how did somebody who's called Miriam Alain, which sounds very Quebecois to my ears, get involved with the Spanish flamenco?
It was a little bit by coincidence. It was mainly through the music at first. I saw the film La Belle Histoire, which doesn't have much to do with flamenco, but I love the music. And then I started buying Paco de Lucia and guitarist and like that. And I just fell in love with the music. And I just decided I'd try a class. And in French you say ça m'a bouleversé. It's something that really came to like I, it was not something that I could control really, and I just decided I would leave for Spain, and I left, and I was there for just about 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, and so you took flamenco dancing. Well, can you take classes?
Yes, you can, and it's getting more and more organized because there's more and more foreigners or non-Spaniards that are studying flamenco. When I got there, it wasn't so organized. You just would pay the teacher and just try to figure out where they were teaching. But more and more, they're getting more organized that way, yeah.
Because from what I understand, flamenco is really something that is kind of organic. Especially the history of flamenco, was the Gitanos who would show up at a, what was it called, a café cantante?
Yeah, historically flamenco is all about, it's a gypsy form of art, historically, but really Spanish and also very Arab, and little by little it's taken place in theaters, and of course today with the influences like artists like like myself, Israel Galvan, a lot of people that are the younger generation, they're really trying to be who they are on stage. They're not trying to be gypsies if they're not, or even if they are, some of them are like, they go to the movies, like, they just live like people here in 2010, right? So they're really integrating their lifestyles to their art form, and so flamenco is really evolving quite fast at the moment.
It felt like more like flamenco fusion to me, because I mean I must say that I have seen a lot of flamenco in my life because my grandma lived in Spain and I spent my summers there. So yeah. Every Sunday TV was on corrida yeah. flamenco. Uh-huh. So what I saw from you though felt much more modern, more lyrical.
Perhaps, yeah. As I said, I think my approach to it is I'm not trying to be a Spaniard. I'm not trying to be a gypsy. I'm Miriam Allard. I'm born in Quebec City. So obviously I'm going to take that into my art form. But within the full respect that I have and love that I have of the traditional art form. And since I spent quite a long time there studying and watching and just seeing how people are there, that's really my base. That's really where I sort of take off from. But of course, you know, I move the way I move, and I try to make it as personal as I can, because that's what I think is interesting. You don't want like a copy of something. You want something that's real. So I'm in this piece especially, I'm not trying to have flamenco lines or aesthetic. I'm just trying to be myself through flamenco and through the theme that we decided to develop in this show.
But what I understand from flamenco is that it's very, there is a repertoire of certain movements. So when a flamenco dancer, like a female flamenco dancer, would start dancing, she could dance with any guy because the guy would recognize the steps and the forms, and you can just sort of fit together. But so do you quote some of those movements, or are you kind of making it up from scratch?
I think... flamenco is very codified, perhaps like ballet, like you have étendu, you have this, and you can with that you can build a piece, and it's very codified, especially I would say for the musicians and for the singer, because it's really a conversation you're having with them. So of course that's completely in my work. It's just that I think the context is more contemporary, and that's perhaps what makes it look not so flamenco, but in itself the music and the steps that I'm using are completely within the repertoire.
Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. That's I reckon I think Allison had some question for you too.
Am I correct in assuming that you also teach?
Yes, I do.
All around the world, the flamenco?
All around the world, yeah. Well, I have, like I cities. Have. Yeah. Since I've been in Montreal a little bit less, because I have my studio now here in Montreal, but I have, yeah.
But so what do you end up teaching then? Do you go back to the basic steps
yes.
there?
Okay. Yes,
and
I
invite
really believe
them to
that you need that to be able to go away from that. You just need that base.
Is it possible for you to strip away everything that you've added to flamenco to be able to pass it on kind of raw to someone else?
Well, as I said, like that's really what I studied. That's really what I go from. So yes, that's really what I teach. I really try to teach something
so that the people who want to go further with it and do something more personal are able to do it without it being something false.
Okay.
Because you have to really know the singing, the music, the steps and everything. You have to really take them in and make them yours before you can go and do something else with it.
Would we be surprised, like looking at a class that you taught versus your performance? Would it be
perhaps
different?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think so.
And why do you choose to perform solo?
Well, flamenco traditionally also is a very soloist form, dance-wise, because there's a lot of improv.
Okay.
And it's really the expression of the singing, basically. So it's a very, in traditional flamenco, it's really you're expressing with your body how you're interpreting the singing, really. So it's hard to do with two people. This being said, I would love to work on duos and perhaps a small group piece, but for now I haven't really been ready to do this. Now I feel that I could, but I found that I really needed to understand my own way of moving before being able to propose this to somebody else.
So how much of this is improvised and how much is scripted?
In the show you saw, it's in every piece there is space for improvisation. Not everything is set, but I would say because of the scenography and because the musicians are moving and so on, it's at least their movements are very set, and in within each tableaus there is space for improvisation. And I'm not satisfied yet with a lot of it, so I'm changing it every night.
No, right?
Yeah.
No, we're going to get to see a different show.
Exactly.
Speaking of the show, first of all, what's its name?
El Doce.
El Doce. Which is for the blokes in the house like myself.
The 12.
The 12.
Yeah.
And you had referenced, a theme is, what is the theme?
Well, 12 beats is, the 12 beat is very flamenco. Like here we're used to listening to music that's in 4 beats and so on. But when you start flamenco, you very quickly, you become sort of obsessed with the 12 because it's quite hard to understand at first. So within that sort of obsession, we started talking with Eddie, who did the directing also in this piece, about how we could adapt that, because most of the most important styles in flamenco are in 12 beats. So from there, we started just looking at the different meanings of 12 that the number 12 actually has in the world. And of course, we came to the 12 hours of a day and to the clock and all that. And what we found quite interesting was that on a clock, but also in flamenco, you start counting on 12 and you also finish on 12. And on the clock, you also have that, you know, it's midnight, but at least in French, it's 00 hour. So there's that sort of end and finish that is the same point. So we just let our minds just go with that, with all the different meanings it could have. And in the end, the show is really, it's divided in 6 tableaus, and it's really about 6 different perceptions perhaps of time.
Okay, and how did you come up with the idea, and what was the process to develop so that you got it on stage? Or what has been the, I assume, since you're still changing it and making it better and better, it is still going through that process?
Oh, and I think I will forever. But we've first started by choosing the styles, the flamenco styles. That's usually how I work. I work first with the music. So we chose the 6 styles that we wanted to work on.
And these are all those tableaus, and are they all separate ones, or do you repeat stuff?
In the music, there is repetition, mm-hmm. But they're quite different. And so from the music, we thought, okay, so in flamenco, it's quite definite. If you see a traditional flamenco show, you'll see an Alegrías, which is really joyful. You'll see a Soleá, which is very dramatic. And so we decided to use those characteristics. I don't know how you say that.
Characteristics, same
exactly.
way in English.
To use those and to see, okay, so how can we interpret the passing of time within that style of flamenco? So that was our starter. And then we also worked, of course, with the composer Caroline Planté, which she did a marvelous job with it. And we also sort of fed her those ideas of, for example, well, this piece we would like to we see it as something, you know, how time can panic you and put so much anguish on you. So how would you say that in music? So that's how we sort of started to work. And then with the video also, we did that work with Geneviève to say, so that, you know, for example, this piece we wanted to be very slow and very floaty, and she came up with images that for her felt that gave those emotions or those sort of interpretations of time.
What gave you the idea to include video? It's a very unusual choice for flamenco.
Yes, it is. Eddie is, I would say, a multidisciplinary artist, and he did a bit of cinema, and he's a maniac of cinema. So he really, really wanted to have video. I was very not insecure about it, because I find video very difficult to integrate in dance. I've seen it a lot, and a lot of the times I find it sort of, you know, it's so impressive, of course, an image, it's so big that the dancer sort of disappears. So I was very skeptical about this, but Eddie and Geneviève, they did the marvelous work, and they really integrated, I find, the video in the piece. So it's not, I don't think it's disturbing. I think on the opposite, it really sort of adds comment. It sort of comments in itself the piece also.
It's like an illustration to your dancing.
Yeah.
And sometimes I don't want to give anything away, but once you even dance with your own self, right?
Yes.
I thought that was very interesting. Yeah. So you really played with the medium. It's not just that you're projecting images. You play a lot with silhouettes and with lights and different screens and depth.
Yeah, that was pretty last minute, actually. And so we're happy it works, because we, of course, it's, you know, it's a question of having the devices and everything. So that was the last week, really. We were like, okay, is it going to work or not? So, but we're glad it does, yeah.
And got to turn my mic back on. And Rebecca and Julian, if you guys have any questions as well, feel free to pipe in.
Thank you.
Free reign for everybody.
Very interesting hearing about your process.
Thanks.
No, there, in terms of also going back to what you said previously about how the show is different than your classes, mm-hmm. that I imagine from the classes being sort of traditional flamenco type stuff, for our radio listening audience, is it possible to describe what the differences between the show and your classes are?
For me, they're not so different, because I guess it's me, but I'm quite strict as a teacher. I'm very demanding, my classes are very technical, because I think that to be able to do something with it, you need a lot of technique. But I try to bring in the musicians as much as I can. I think what would link both, again, is the music, because the way I work is also always from the music, from the rhythm, from the spirit of the styles of flamenco. I think that in that sort of point, people would recognize it somehow, because then it's for me, flamenco in the end is really just a you know, it's like a something you wear. It's just a way of expressing something. So, and I think that's how I teach also. I really try to get the students to feel the different styles, and to feel it not only in their body, but also to be able to sort of send that out.
So you don't need a Spanish soul. I mean, what if you're completely awkward as a 6-foot blonde, you know, going there and trying to pretend a little girl from Andalusia?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think you have to pretend. I think that in that way, flamenco is very universal. I think it's an art form that, you know, it's and I think that's why also it touches us here in Canada. I was in Japan for 6 months working, and the theater was packed every night. I mean, so obviously there's something in flamenco that is just, you know, it's about the human condition. So that'll go get just about any person wherever they're from. So I think the idea again is just to to be very honest in your process and to try to you know, get the technique enough to be able to say something with it, of course, because that's your vocabulary. But then once you have that, then I think you're very free to do whatever you want, you know.
Aside from the universality of it, have you noticed different receptions in different places, like in Japan, for example? Like,
Yeah, I would say yes. I think, the Japanese, they're very special that way. They're either very reserved or completely hysterical. So when they see, like, I would think of Farruquito, who's like the Michael Jackson of flamenco, like, they'll be crying the whole way. I would say I've seen more in class, because of course in the audience it's usually more or less the same, but in class I would say it's quite different there, because, well, when I was teaching in Japan, like, it's amazing the discipline they have, because you'll say, okay, we'll do this exercise, and I can go out to the toilet and come back and they're still doing it. Like, they're really, really very precise, and rhythmically they're super fast. And then when I taught in France and more southern European places, you see that, well, they won't have as much compass, as much rhythm, but they'll be perhaps freer in their way of moving, because in Japan, you know, you have to be in a certain way, especially women. So yeah, I think, of course, you know, I think that'll happen with any type of art form, that the reception is cultural somehow also.
Yeah, cultural. That's really it. We're interpreting a culture that was developed elsewhere, mm-hmm. and then we inhabit another culture, and then sort of, I find that you're nearly subverting flamenco to your own needs. And what I notice is that a lot of these traditional dances, after a while, they sort of fade out, and maybe by what you're doing is injecting new life into flamenco by making it relevant to people who are not in Spain, and therefore maybe flamenco would live a longer life if more people would do that.
Well, I think in Spain there are quite a lot of the younger generation again that are really working hard that way. I think of Israel Galvan, Rocio Molina, Andres Marin. They're really making an effort to be themselves, really, through that, and not to put it in a box and leave it there, because it's not folklore. It's existing right now, and it's actual and it's contemporary. And for me, I make an allusion a lot to jazz that way, like jazz, you know, it comes from African American, that's all their suffering and all that. But I mean, I've heard a fantastic Norwegian jazz player, and he's from Norway, you know. So what, for me, it's very much the same. It comes from somewhere, and I think you have to respect that, of course. And you know, I love traditional flamenco, and I still do it, and I have a lot of respect for it. But I think it's an art form, and as any type of art form, it should evolve.
Yeah, the parallel you make to jazz is really interesting, actually. That's a very good point. So where are your classes, and when can we take them?
I want to see you flamenco.
We have a studio down in Southwest, close to Metro Charlevoix, very close to the Atwater Market. Mm-hmm. It's called Studio Pléamar. And now I'm not actually teaching because of the shows and everything. But I have another teacher there, so we're sort of developing the studio, which is a studio space more than a school. Like, you don't have so many different levels. But I really enjoy teaching, and so I try to, you know, I see it also as a, not a responsibility, but I think that, you know, there should have flamenco, like good quality flamenco classes here in Montreal, because there's such a community in dance here. So, and I enjoy teaching also. So I try to be quite steady and regular in my classes.
And then the show. We need details on that, because you also said that you got to get the hell out of Dodge at 2:30.
Yes. So we're playing at 5e Salle of Place des Arts until Saturday, 17th of April. And then we're going to Sherbrooke, Toronto, and Trois-Rivières. So we're touring all the way to the 1st of May.
Okay. And The website is laotraorilla.net.
Yes.
I got it right down in front of me. I would not have been able to do that otherwise.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for coming in. I'm looking forward to the show, seeing the show, especially seeing or judging by Bettina's reaction.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And yes, it's 2:30, just about 2:30 minus 15 seconds. You're listening to Movement Museum on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on your cable dial, and movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer. And we will be on Flickr eventually. We'll see you in, or we'll hear you in about 30 seconds after this ad. And we're back. That's, the music that's playing in the background is Miles Davis's Star People. A friend of mine loaned this to me, and this is one of his later albums. Has absolutely nothing to do with hooping, has nothing to do with flamenco, but I had not heard late Miles Davis music, and it was handy, and we just shove it in. Rebecca, Julian, I'm going to have to talk to you without making eyesight and eye contact.
Here,
but there you can
way.
Make contact with eye contact with Allison, Elizabeth, and Bettina, who are... I'm not going to even go there. Let's just ignore that and say that I didn't have a sexist thought in my head at all. But yes, thank you very much both for coming in.
Thank you.
And,
hello.
Mm-hmm. And who wants to start?
So, hooping, you teach and you perform. Tell us all about it.
Okay, well, hooping, it's nice that you referred it to it as hooping, because initially a lot of people call it hula hooping, which makes reference to the 1950s
hooping phenomenon, which it was mostly just around the waist then. And hooping nowadays, Rebecca and myself, we and everyone else in the hoop community spin it from our waist to our neck, to our hands, to our feet, off the body, on the body. Everything in between.
how do you spin it off the body?
Off the body. So core hooping, first of all, we use a plastic. It's a piece of plastic that we use. it was interesting hearing about the history, a little bit about how much history there is to flamenco, because there's, of course, a lot of history to hooping as well, going back to indigenous cultures and that type of thing, and spinning the small hoops, if you've ever seen in native cultures, they have the small hoops and they tell stories with the hoops and all kinds. So it goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. But
which natives of... Canada?
Of Canada and the U.S., yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah, yeah. And then also, that's a very interesting thing that basically goes to history of hooping. But what we do, actually, the history goes into rave culture. So it started with the String Cheese Incident, which is like this band that went around and threw out hula hoops into the audience, and people started hooping, they called it, with these big, heavy hoops. And people hadn't seen hoops since the 1950s, of course. And so... It was this sort of freedom movement of a new way of dancing. And so it really all comes back to dance. And that's basically what we do, is we dance in the hoop and we teach other people how to dance using this piece of plastic. So a lot of people are afraid to dance. They're like, I can't dance. I don't know how to dance. But we really start at the feet. We teach people how to do weight transfer and all these fundamental movement qualities based on somatics, contemporary dance, yoga, and in the last 3 years, it's really interesting because all of these people who have started hooping in their individual communities have come together for things like Hoop Convergence and Hoop Camp, and hundreds of hoopers gather, and there's workshops. I'm going to North Carolina in May to teach a workshop at Hoop Convergence. Wow. And then I'm going to California to teach a workshop at Hoop Camp. So it's kind
That's
of
amazing.
Interesting. I started hooping in BC. It's kind of a West Coast
phenomenon, and then it's sort of, there was people doing it in New York as well in the States, but when I came to Montreal, I came here to find like a hooping community. I was like, if anywhere in Canada has hooping, it's going to be Montreal, you know. So
how is the hooping community in Montreal?
Well, it started out, there was two of us there.
Some community.
Yeah, in 2005 when I got here, I went to the Tam Tam festivals because everybody said if you want to find circus people, go to the Tam Tam. So I went there and I met this I went there a few times, and then finally I met this other girl. Her name's also Rebecca. So we're the two hula hooping Rebeccas, and she does circus. She's a clown. She does circus style hula hooping. So we kind of met, and I was like, you know, I really want to create this community that exists on the West Coast, you know, in California and all these places, or this that I'd heard about. I'd never experienced it, but I'd heard about it. And so I started offering hoop classes and performing, and eventually I met another hooper named Julia, which is quite confusing because now I work with Julian, who's sitting across the table from me. But so we performed all over Canada and the U.S. with our hoop troupe. And then just last year, Julie N came into my life, and he's been helping me out, and he started out by taking our workshops. We have a performance intensive, a teacher training, and weekly hoop classes, monthly hoop workshops, and Julian's done absolutely everything in the last year, and now he's, you know,
risen to the top.
He's risen to the top of I Hoop You, which is our company. So yeah, we're doing all kinds of stuff. We're completely crazy about hooping and hoops.
So explain to me the taxonomy of hooping. So there's the 1950s hooping, which is just basically trying to get this thing around, going around your waist. Mm-hmm. And then you said something about circus hooping, and then there's the hooping that you do. So how does that differ?
Okay, so 1950s hula hooping, small, light plastic hoops that are really hard. It's back-breaking almost because they don't have any weight to them. Circus hooping, the hoops are slightly heavier, made of different materials.
Sometimes metal.
Sometimes metal.
Wow.
And it's usually consists of multiple hoops and separating the hoops on different parts of the core body, not very much off the body hooping, which means having the hoop in the hand and swinging the hoop as a counterweight around the body. A contemporary hoop dance, what we do, definitely different dance elements. So whatever your background is, salsa, contemporary dance, jazz, flamenco, you could do any of it with a hoop around your waist. And then in addition to that, there's a whole bunch of hoop repertoire. So simple waist hooping, moving it up and down the body, taken from, it's sort of, there's all sorts of appropriation of these different circus techniques and different ways of hooping. So what we do, it started out with these big heavy hoops, and now, as you can see by this hoop, they've gotten
great.
Smaller and smaller and smaller. And so now Julian and I, we started out with 42-inch hoops that were massive and heavy, and now we hoop with 32-inch hoops. So we've kind of, as you get better, you can hoop with a smaller hoop, but it's all about being free in the hoop and moving, and there's really a focus on what you're doing from the top of your head to your toes, to your fingertips, really finding extension in all your movement when you're core body hooping, and then when it's off the body, using the hoop as a weight, almost as if you're doing contact dance or something. So you have a partner and you're really reacting and exchanging information with this hoop.
And the hoops that you brought into the studio, they are quite special. They come apart. You can bend them into, you know, some sort of wearable accessory.
It ends up being, you're living in the city, carrying around a big 42-inch giant hoop on transit or biking around with it ends up being really difficult, especially in Montreal.
Awkward.
It's a lot of people around. So we have compact ones that break down into four pieces. They're about, you know, 30 inches long, really small. You put that into your yoga bag, throw it on your back, you know, take it with you on your bike. It just makes it a lot more easier to throw out a hula hoop and jam out in the park or, you know, at a club if you have room for it.
Yeah.
What are they made out of nowadays? You talk about, because I assume it's still plastic and stuff like that.
We're trying to move towards recycled materials eventually, but currently, we make them out of PVC plastic.
Okay, and that PVC plastic is then different than the Mattel hula hoops that I grew up with?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. The dollar store hoops are a little bit too light.
There's this thing called PSI, so it's the density of the tubing, the density of the material that's used contributes to a different weight of the hoop. So the hoops that you were using had a low PSI, and the ones that we use, in fact, the hoops that are sold, that are made and sold by hoop entrepreneurs in the U.S. and hoop artisans are different than the hoops that are made and sold in Canada, because we buy our material, it comes from like the plumbing supply, or irrigation or whatever. And so because of different climates, if you're in South USA, it's going to be different than Northern Canada, And so this all contributes to hooping culture. There's actually this website called hooping.org as well, which is, it's amazing. It's this resource for hoopers. And every year there's an election for female hooper of the year, male hooper of the year, top hoop community of the year, and all this kinds of stuff. So it's great. This is an international phenomenon that's happening right now, and it's we're doing our best to bring it to the surface and share it with everyone, because it's so much fun. People come to class and they have a great time, and then they leave and they're like, man, my abs feel good. And so it's this whole thing about fun fitness that's just, aside from community and making new friends and dancing around with a plastic toy to music, you're also getting a good workout.
And some of these things light up. You have LED ones and fire.
Yes. For our performances, we use LED hoops, which they're plastic hoops, clear, and then when you turn them on, they glow. So they have LED lights inside of them. So, and it creates this psychedelic effect that creates all kinds of beautiful images for our audiences. And then we also have fire hoops, which actually, Allison, I think you saw.
Oh yeah, several times the show. That's so much fun. It's mesmerizing and terrifying at the same time. You've got this hoop with these spokes at the end of it that are on fire while you're hula hooping. Oh, it was great, though.
Yeah, last year I performed with Stu, a dancer. We did a collaboration. He was spinning fire staff and I was spinning fire hoop. And so Julian and I are going to put together a fire hoop show this summer, and where we do acrobatics and fire hoop at the same time. We're very excited about it. And so we use these hoops that have spokes on the end and light them on fire. And the hoop itself is not on fire. It's got,
thank God.
Yeah. Otherwise.
But when you get it going fast enough, it almost has the illusion that you've got this like hoop of fire around you.
Yeah, exactly, because there's six spokes, and when you're moving the fire, it doesn't stay in the same place, so it does become a ring of fire. And if you've got the hoop around your neck, then it actually, the fire is quite close to your face.
Yikes. And your eyebrows burnt off?
Yeah, you have to be careful. You really have to be careful with your hair and what you're wearing, because there are risks involved.
Now, there, what I wanted to kind of, if you have the LED ones, you're going to have to learn, or somebody should, I wish I could, but do you know the Arduino controllers?
No.
These are microcontrollers that are basically, you can hook up to your computer, and there's, you know how you've seen the digital clocks, which then have the LEDs sweeping in the air, so it says time? And you can then also have them say phrases and stuff like that, and it's just like they're sort of dancing in the air. And so you can then have a complete sort of phrase that's, and that it changes, and you can set it up so that you can have words scrolling around your waist.
So this is where we need an electrical engineer to come.
No. It's all DIY. It's part of the same culture.
This is amazing. This just goes to demonstrate that, some people say, is hooping just a fad? Is it going to come and go? But the more I meet people and they talk to me about things like this that just blow my mind, it just goes to show that hooping, the possibilities are endless with this circle, And these hoop conferences that we go to, every time we go, there's people doing these amazing things that you would never think about.
Is it more of a solo thing, though? Because if you have two hoopers next to each other, you need a lot of space around you, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, what Julian and I do, we've been studying acro yoga with Jesse and Eugene at Ashtanga Yoga Montreal. And so we've been combining acro yoga with hooping. So I do a lot of hooping with the hoops on my feet, where I do a hooping headstand where I spin the hoop around my foot, and all kinds of floor work from contemporary dance with the hoop on my feet. And so we've kind of been taking that movement, and then Julian's been basing, so he's been on the ground and lifting me up with his feet. And so, I mean, it creates quite a duet.
Right, but with an obstacle, being the hoop.
or a compliment, or an accessory.
It is part of you, it is not a foreign object.
That's a good point.
And that's what we really teach in class, too. It's all about, rather the hoop being part of your body or an extension of your body. And I studied a lot of Laban. I did the dance program at Concordia, and so one of the things I got really interested in while I was there was Laban and how he did all this research on planes and tetrahedrons and all this kind of stuff. And so often when you're hooping, we talk about planes in hooping, so you have your horizontal plane and then your vertical plane, and I just found so many similarities between those two things. So while I was studying dance, I mean, I went to dance school to learn more about the body and how the body can relate to an object, and so there was plenty of things that just blew my mind that I haven't even had time to dive into yet, you know, because I'm trying to keep my classes going, which is exciting because we have people who are now, we have 10 teacher trainers who have graduated from our teacher training program, and they're going to be teaching all the weekly classes this summer, which is really exciting because we have 10 outdoor park classes happening this summer. So
talking about a growing hoop community, we've gone from two hoopers 4 or 5 years ago now to having filled out classes.
That's two to two, and it does grow exponentially.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of the time, I think people, because we hula hoop in the park in the summertime, because, I mean, being outside makes it so much.
Which park?
Any and all. A lot of the time, Park La Fontaine, because a lot of circus artists are there Wednesdays. Well, every day, but Wednesday night, I think, is their specific night. But we'll go there and we'll just, you know, be hula hooping and, you know, Rebecca and I training or whatever. And someone will just come over and be like, "What are you doing?" "Oh, you know, it's the hula hoop. Try it out." And the moment that they have it around their waist and they're going for it and they're like, "Whoa, I can keep this up. I, you know, this is a lot of fun." And then, you know, they're coming to our classes and they're bringing their friends. And even, you know, for myself, I picked up a hula hoop and I really just couldn't put it down. It became this really addicting
form of exercise.
Yeah. Well, for me, it wasn't about the exercise. It was just about, you know, wanting to get these tricks or wanting to kind of move forward with it. But then all of a sudden realizing that, whoa, I have a really flat stomach. I have really strong abs now just because I'm pushing this really heavy hoop.
Okay, sign me up. When?
Pretty much. starting in May, we have classes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Every day of the week.
Wow.
And every Thursday night at the Y.
Okay. And I heard you in Studio 303 as well?
Yes, on Mondays. Actually, our class on Mondays at 303 is a level 2 class now because our students are getting so good. So we've had to bump that up. So now Thursday nights at the Y is open to all levels, but Monday nights at 303 is level 2 because they need some challenge now. These people have been coming for a while.
What's the difference between what are the challenges?
In level 1, we really focus on dancing with the hoop and feeling comfortable with the hoop and not dropping the hoop and basic body awareness, a lot of elements from yoga and really a focus on weight transfer and basic fundamental hoop moves, which involve moving the hoop from the waist up to above the head, around the body, so swinging the hoop around the body, and really being aware of alignment while one is doing all these movements. And then there's a whole repertoire of hoop tricks that are taught in level 1. And then once students have a good grasp of these tricks and this vocabulary that they can use with the hoop and they feel pretty free in the hoop, then we bring it up to level 2, which involves more, well, there's a choreography element in level two. Part of that choreography element is learning choreography. The other part is creating choreography. So there's two elements, which then, well, in level two, we stay, yeah. And then there's level two hoop moves. And there's also, what else is there in level two, Julian?
You start bringing in multiple hoops on the body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
More than one. So more like the circus stuff.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of circus technique, yeah. There's different techniques involved, so just more, and concepts. In level one, it's really, we stick to sort of being physical, and in level two, we start thinking about things while we're doing them and applying concepts to what we're doing. So,
what do you mean by that?
Okay, well, you're working with a circle, right? So, for example, isolations. An isolation is when you move the hoop in space, but it occupies the same space, basically. But you're not moving it right, left, or up, down. So I'd be moving. It creates an illusion, basically, and that is really a juggling technique or a poi technique. And so basically, when we start to apply concepts, it opens up a whole other level for students so that they can create their own moves. And, you know, we're sort of spoon-feeding students in level one so that they can gain a repertoire, whereas in level two, we're really giving them things that can sort of let them expand and create their own repertoire. Because I'm a big fan of, rather than just teaching somebody to look exactly like me when they hoop, I want people to find themselves in the hoop and find their own style.
And is there music that goes with hooping, or does it not require music?
You could definitely hoop in silence, but one of the great things about hooping is that that I've heard from my students is that it's a great way to find rhythm. Mm-hmm. You know, you have this object and you can push the object back and forth to the beat of the music. And so,
but not too slow, because then it'll fall down.
Well, you can actually see how slow you can go without letting it fall down. That's one of the fun parts about it.
Is there any particular music that you find is better to hoop to than others?
You can hoop to whatever music you like.
Your personal
preference. I love electronic music. That's really, I've always been a fan of electronic music. We love going to Picnic Electronique on Sundays. That's really where you'll find us. Once that starts, we're there every week. And so yeah, we really like we really like dirty electro house, actually. And I mean, we're from the West Coast, and that's huge. Of course, dubstep. You know, dubstep's really big right now. That's really fun to hoop to, because you can get really, there's kind of like this slow, like juicy beat going on, and there's other different layers. Yeah, I mean, drums are great. I went to the Tam Tams on Sunday, and you know, drums are great. So really fun, primal, too. You know, bounce, you can too. Really, yeah.
Do you have anything, Allison? I'm putting these spotlight.
I have a question about these awesome collapsible hoops. If given the choice, like, is there a disadvantage at all to them? Would you rather have a solid hoop, or do they feel just the same when you're using them?
Well, this is another thing. When you start hooping, you want a bigger, heavier hoop. So, I mean, I think the ninja hoop, the travel hoop, the one that breaks into four pieces, is great for a beginner, because you can bring it. Hooping is all about doing it all the time, you know?
Right, practice.
And not even practice, just having it with you. And so if your hoop's sitting in the closet at home, and you're at wherever you're at, a party, and the music is great, and you think, oh, I wish I had my hoop, you know? Well, then you don't want to bring it on the bus or whatever, on your bike. So that's why a collapsible is great, because you can just, I mean, I bungee cord my hoop to my bike, or I wear it.
Somebody should develop a original bicycle wheel with removable spokes.
bicycle. Oh, yeah, to hoop, to hoop. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's actually this guy named Dizzy Hips. He holds the world record, all the world records for hooping. I think he snowboards and hoops, and he runs and hoops, and he's hooped with the most hoops. He's hooped for the longest. Anyway, he holds, I think, every single world record in hooping, and he hooped with a tire.
Wow.
Yeah, I met him at Burning Man, and he was pushing around this tire. And yeah, anyway, so well,
I imagine, my understanding of physics is such, the heavier it is, once you get that inertia going, once you get it up and spinning, then at which point it's way easy to keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, tire being real heavy and stuff like that, yes, you have to be strong to get it up and moving, but once it's going, you probably can almost stand still.
Yeah, well, it's interesting too, because I've met artists that do the sear wheel, and I've asked them, have you ever tried to hoop that? But I think it would probably break your back, so you have to be careful with how heavy you go. You know, the tire would probably have some give for your spine, but yeah.
And then the question I had, and again, Allison, you haven't been talking an awful lot this week, okay, so by all means, cut me off if you have. In terms of for performances, because there it's recognized with the classes and stuff like that, it's pretty much everybody is hooping by themselves. It looks like a lot of line dancers together, except they're spinning things. Because you do performances as well, and for that, yeah, how do you go about conceiving them and organizing them?
Our creative process.
Yes, I'm endlessly fascinated with the process.
Yeah, well, as a student of Concordia University, there's a big emphasis on creative process there. It's all, I feel like for 3 years, you know, we talked about creative process and developed a creative process. So my creative process has definitely been influenced by the 3 years I spent creating dance at Concordia. Usually it starts out in the studio with, when I was working solo, it would be me and my hoop, and just, you know, either music, no music, just trying to come up with something new. Now I've started working with music a lot more and just finding flow. There's this thing, one of the elements, actually it's a big element in both level one and level two, is called flow. And so flow is when you start moving with the hoop and you let yourself go and you kind of try, you just try and keep going without stopping. And this flow often will bring you somewhere if you keep going, because often we're limited by judgments or criticisms of whatever we're doing or thoughts or distractions. But if you let yourself get into this flow, often it will take you somewhere. And so, that's something I've been exploring a lot recently. It's always different working with Julian. So as we've been working together, usually what we do is we create sequences, and it starts with a sequence.
Just throwing together three of our favorite moves.
Yeah, and then it's expanding. So taking, say, three tricks and then that don't necessarily go together, and then finding a way to string these tricks together, and how can we put these together? And then what comes in between the trick? And then what's in between the trick often becomes the central focus. So it's based around these transitions. So that would be, I guess, the preliminary movement research. I usually start with movement research. I've worked with some concepts before. I actually have a residency at MPAC in May, coming up in May. It's a 2-week video residency with Maritas Carino, and we're basically doing research in this amazing space for 2 weeks. And that piece, it's called Hoop, and it's much different than what I do with Julian, which is mostly centered around sparkles and color and all these very over the top kind of themes. And then the other side of what I do is very black and white and minimalistic, which goes back to the piece I created in 2007 at Tangent. So that is more about my process revolves more, well, I talked a lot with Maritas, and it started with this sort of tunnel vision thing and the hoop and all the things that the hoop could represent, and the circle, and put in different contexts. And so, I mean, I would say my process changes depending on what the project is.
At which point we are up against the top of the hour, prime time's in the house, coming up with Positive Vibes. I want to thank Rebecca Halls, Julian Hughes. Thank you very much. We got to get your website.
ihoopu.com, and it's the letter U. So ihoopu.com.
And your classes are you in? Can anybody just walk into them at any time, or is there sort of a series that starts at this time and ends at that time?
We have a level 2 class starting on Monday, and Thursdays at the Y you can drop in any time. We have a beginner, if you're a beginner and you've never hooped before and you want to learn to hoop, come on April 25th. We've got a hoop dance basics 2-hour session from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at it's at Studio Wants and Needs Dance.
Which Y?
The Park Y.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all on the website.
Okay.
So
go to ihoopu.com.
Yes.
And yes, thank you very, very much both for coming in. Allison Elizabeth, thank you very much. Bettina, thank you very much. My name's Zeke. This is Movement Museum on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on your cable dial, and movement-museum.blogspot.com. We will speak to you next week at about the same time.